So thank you for your kindness, not only to the people. That's right. Yeah, thank you for your kindness, not only for the people of Haiti and the children there who you're definitely helping, but thank you for making me feel good this morning by letting me teach. Lighten up, people. All right. So, where's Cool? He's gone. All right, guys. So here's what we're doing this morning. We're going to do some teaching. We're going to take communion together. And then we're going to spend some time breaking out and praying with one another. And so all of that will happen really very quickly over the next 60 minutes. Over the last, I guess, month, we've been looking at, in particular, issues that have been affecting people here, which makes sense because I guess we could talk about a lot of things that may not resonate or not be important to the people here at TLR, but these items have been taken from cards that have been submitted in a variety of fashions of things that people are dealing with. And so this particular week, what we're looking at is the way of Jesus and strained or broken relationships. Do you realize how difficult this is? Do you realize what kind of heavy topic this is? In my book, outside of this kind of Jesus salvation message, which I would rank as maybe the most important thing in our faith, relationships, in my book, are the most difficult, and they rank, for me, as the second most important thing. Because you have on one end the whole loving God element, but then translating that into loving people, maybe not even getting that far, but liking people, or even to go further, loving your friends, but loving your enemies. So we've got our work cut out for us to get to any sort of place where we can even begin to take a step toward the kind of relationships that Jesus would want us to have, the kind of restorative relationships that we should be pursuing in our lives. So really what we're starting off doing, I think, let me ask, Judy, you've dealt with people for several years in the counseling world. How difficult is the pathway of reconciliation or mending relationships that have been strained or broken?
Very.
Why do you think that it's so difficult?
It's hard for them to let go of things that have happened in the past to where they can have a clean. It's still there. How they've been affected by whatever happened.
So you're saying that there's such a woundedness that's there because of distrust, betrayal.
It just
hurts people to such a degree that even getting to a baseline of starting fresh is difficult, let alone having a healing and mended relationship. So as you guys can see, we're starting off. And you know what? The truth is that this affects every single one of us here. There's not one person here that this does not affect right here and right now. Am I right or wrong? Because I know it affects me, and I know that there are people within my life, and I know that there's people within your lives who really push your buttons, that have done things that have offended you, that have hurt you, that have wounded you, that have broken you. Even getting to a place where you can be in the same room is difficult, let alone saying, I forgive you. So I think that maybe a good launching point for us this morning is a verse that I just thought of this week that really has very little to do with the overall teaching, but it serves as a nice foundation for where we're going. If you just pop the first one up, it doesn't even matter the context in which we're reading this verse from Jesus. He just says, what is impossible with man is possible with God. And it has to be an amazing baseline to begin with. Because I can tell you that there are people that you're thinking of right now, whether it be parents, whether it be friends, whether it be ex-spouses, other people you've been in a relationship with, who've put you in a position where you've probably said either out loud or in your mind, loving this person is impossible. Being a friend with this person is impossible. Being in the same room with this person is impossible. What do you guys think? I mean, if there's been a fracture or a break in a relationship between two people within a family, within relationships, I think that maybe our first natural inclination as human beings is to say, I deserve better than this. I don't have to work towards healing this. I hope that person, I mean, on one end you could say, people have probably said, I just wish that person would die. Maybe to a lesser extreme, I don't ever want to see you again. These are really poignant questions and considerations. And I think that if we're even to get to the point in our faith where Christianity or the way of Christ becomes less about a philosophy and less about a religion and more about a new way of living and a new way of being, then we're kind of going in the right direction. That's the right start of saying, I'm not interested in cheap philosophies. I'm not interested in adopting the philosophy of Jesus. I'm not interested in this dogmatic religion. I'm interested in learning how the Spirit of God can work within my life in such a way where the impossible is possible. Another great verse, once again, I may be taking this out of context, and I don't care. But let's throw up the next one. Jesus is speaking to the teachers of the law, but I think that the application here is right on. He says, therefore, every teacher of the law who has become a disciple in the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as the old. And I submit to you that the people who follow in the way of Christ are those who are bringing out new treasures for the world to see. That yes, maybe the world has seen the old treasures put on display, and maybe they know the laws and the rules and how things ought to be. But I submit to you that the new treasures that we're a part of, that we get to bring out and demonstrate and display to the world, is the way of Jesus in each and every situation. That's something that people are waiting to see. Okay? So that's just kind of setting the foundation of where we're going this morning. I'm going to take a look at Matthew 22, 34 through 40. You don't really have to have a Bible this morning. If you have one, great, grab it, open it up. I'm going to be supplying all of that on the front slides. So let's take a look at Matthew 22, 34 through 40. No? Okay. Well, then we'll read it. Matthew 22, 34 through 30. Does anybody have that? They can stand up and read it for us in a very robust. Thanks, K-Love. Mr. K-Fed. Matthew 22, 34 through 40.
A lot. 34?
Yep.
But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees with his reply, they met together to question him again. One of them, an expert in religious law, tried to trap him with this question. Teacher, which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses? And Jesus replied, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments.
No, that's good. That's perfect. Foundational words from Jesus. Okay, we've heard it 1,000 times. love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. And then secondly, love others as yourself. Do you see how this already aligns itself? You love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. So there's love in one direction between us and God. And then as a result of that love, where does it extend? Let's go to the next one. I think that we possibly have a slide for this one. Luke 6:27. It says, Luke 6:32-33, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. Let's take a look at the next one. Let's go back. I did a very poor job this morning of putting together my slides, so I just have to tell you that. Let's look at Luke 6:27. Does somebody have that? Luke 6:27. One line.
I got it.
Actually, just read that again so we can hear it again.
I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, and bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Chase. Look at this. But I tell you who hear me, love your... No, please go back. That's perfect. There we go. But I tell you, hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. I don't know about you, but when I took grammar in high school, whenever you have a sentence that says something like, love your enemies, what's the noun in this? Because it's implied, right?
Understood.
It's understood. But it's talking directly to you. And I did a quick search in the New International Version, all of the New Testament, just the word you, to see how many times that it came up. And it came up so many times that I could not even get through all of them. But I'll tell you that from the verses that we've looked at so far on the screen, whether it be Luke 6:27, whether it be Luke 6:32-33, whether it be Matthew 22:34-40, the words are directed specifically to you, not anyone else, but Jesus is speaking to you. And I think that that's really important, because how many times in a relationship gone south, or any time whenever you're in a disagreement with someone, do you look at yourself first? Or is it to the other person who's caused the problems? If the other person would just get fixed, then we wouldn't have an issue. If the other person would just understand my feelings, then if I could only twist their arm into submission, that they would do what I want them to do. If they would only listen to how logical I make my point and how eloquent I am when I make it, they would completely understand why I do what I do. But it's always us trying to control, manipulate, change the other person. We spend a lot of time in our disagreements wanting the other person to get on our page. Is it just me? We spend a lot of time in our disagreements standing our ground and saying the other person's the issue or the problem. The other person's the offender. The other person is the agitator. The other person called me a name. The other person slandered me. The other person... And so I have every right to remain where I am. And I'm just going to let you on in a little secret, and maybe this isn't necessarily biblical as much as it is just common everyday advice and wisdom. You can't change the other person. Can you?
By acting righteously toward them, you could.
Oh, well, you're jumping ahead. I mean, seriously. previously. Doug, how many times have you and Julie been in an argument and she's been mad at you? Four times.
Yeah.
See? That's four times more than Jenny and I. So no, but maybe I'll ask Julie since you're so perfect. Now, how many times have you guys been in a situation where you've been in a disagreement or an argument and you tried to change him, change his mind, change his heart, change all the time? And how many times does it work?
Never.
No, I mean, I think with every ounce of good intention that we have, I think that we're maybe misaligned if we have the idea that in a disagreement or an issue or in a problem with someone else that we are going to change them. I don't think that we're going to convince them of our rightness, convince them to be on the same page.
And we're just going to cause them to dig.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it. By us worrying so much about the other person and spending efforts to that end, we could potentially be digging a greater hole. We could be making things worse. We could be pushing things further apart. I like this idea of loving God and loving others because I think that this is the place where we find this perfect union, okay? When we have perfect union with God, when we've experienced the love of God in our hearts and our minds and our souls, we as individuals, I think that we have an easier time beginning that process of extending outward this love and compassion and service and kindness to other people. I think that when we have understand this union with God, we can extend that union to other people, and that's where things start fitting together. The word that is used throughout the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, is an old Hebrew word known as shalom. And I like the way that this author describes shalom. It says in the Bible, shalom connotes the complete well-being of a society or community because, okay, let's back up. Shalom connotes the complete well-being of a society or community because it has a strong communal emphasis. Shalom necessitates right, harmonious relationships to other human beings. And so the ways that neighborhoods, let's back up, the ways that families begin experiencing shalom, the ways that neighborhoods begin experiencing shalom, the ways that communities, cities, towns begin to experience shalom, where you have this rightness, this wholeness, this completeness, begins at a very individual level. Okay? Right, harmonious relationships with other human beings. But do we understand the beginning point for all of this is us beginning to experience shalom between us and God? That's the beginning point. Whenever we've experienced the love of God, whenever we experience this mending and healing and reconciliation in our own lives and in our own hearts, all the ways that you've been hurt, all the ways that you've been broken, all the ways that you've been fractured, all the ways that your emotions have been stepped on, all the ways that you've been drugged through the mud, when you've experienced the healing grace of God in your heart, that's the beginning point to start extending that outward. That's where healing within your family begins. That's where healing within relationships begin. And as people, and as other people experience this, it extends outward into neighborhoods, towns, cities. But it has to begin somewhere, and it has to begin with you as an individual. John 13, 34 and 35 says this, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." How will people know that you're a disciple of Jesus?
Love one another.
Love one another. How will people not know if you're a disciple of Jesus? By simple deduction. you've extended something other than love? You've extended something less than love? How will people ever know the love of God if it's not extended from the people of God? There's a passage in Matthew. I'm taking everything out of context today, so just put a star next to it and know it. But there's this beautiful passage where Jesus is talking about his children and the role and responsibility of his children on earth. And he says it very clearly. He says, either you are gathering or you are scattering. And to me, it's just that simple. Are you people who are contributing to the problem by scattering that which other people are trying to gather? To me, that's frustrating. If I'm trying to pick up something and my kids are knocking over everything that I'm picking up, what good is it? It only makes sense that the children of God, the people who align themselves with Jesus, ought to be those who are working together in unity to gather that which needs gathered instead of scattering. I think that sets us up very nicely. I have rarely seen a relationship in which the blame is all on one person. Okay? I've never seen a relationship where the blame is all on one person. There's always an element of something else going on. We are all contributors. You just can't look at a relationship and say this person is 100% to blame, because I think if you look within the relationship, there are things that have led to this relationship falling apart. This is not to say that it doesn't happen. There are instances, I guess, where one person arbitrarily just goes out and ruins the relationship. But it is to say that before we go so far as to place all of the blame on one person, I think we should honestly, humbly, maybe even vulnerably start with ourselves and look inward. Instead of casting the first stone, maybe we should look at ourselves.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yes. That's awesome. Man, thank you, Julie. I don't know. I think about my own relationships. I think about my own marriage. And I am so quick.
Wait a second.
See, if instead of recording the audio of these things, if we could record the video, that would have been priceless. I thought you were going to come and hug me and say, you're sorry. There we go. Now things are good. So, now I'm sweating. Woo!
You guys just felt it.
In my own relationships, in my own marriage, my beginning point has fatally been the other person. It's his fault. It's her fault. Why do we do that? Makes us feel better? It kind of hurts whenever we have to look at ourselves and say that we're the problem. But I'm not the problem. I've never done anything wrong. I've never done anything in this situation.
I think in human nature, when we have something to look at and say, this is the source, this is what's caused this, this is where it's from, we feel better because we know where it's coming from, instead of it could be multiple things.
Yep.
But we have this tendency as human beings to look at one central focal point and say, this is where it's from, this is bad, I can cut off black and white here.
Yep.
And then once we establish that, then all of our thoughts go to proving that.
Exactly.
So we exclude all the other suspects.
It has to be this, and this thing is evil.
And I'll get to you in a second, Julie, but the thing about it is that if you do not as an individual start with yourself as being the beginning of the problem, and you build up your walls around yourself and say, I've already made up my mind, it's set in stone, I am not the problem, I am not the contributor to the problem, there's nothing that I've done. If someone else comes to you and says, here's what I want to tell you about yourself, do you realize that what you've already done, you've excluded any possibility, you've excluded people who might be able to speak truth into your life. You've already put up a barrier of someone maybe who you really do love and trust saying, you know what, I'm looking at the situation in an unbiased way, and here's what I see from you. Here's what I see you doing. But we can create these barriers and these guards to protect ourselves in such a way where nothing can break in to even begin a heart change on our own part. I mean, think about that. If you are guarded and angry and mad and you have your walls built up, if God can't even break into your own heart, then how in the world is God going to work you through you for healing of relationships? Let me say a bit.
I'll speak some truth.
Yeah.
You got windows open or something outside, you don't want to get wet.
Listen to that truth.
Windows and bicycles.
And I think that what you're telling me is less about the words and more about the spirit of it. And that's exactly where we need to get to.
I've heard another story granted that might be in this too. If I'm not the problem, there is no solution.
If I'm not the problem, there's no solution. I can see that in my own life. So let me sum it up. We cannot change other people. We cannot make them change their hearts or their minds. We cannot twist their arms into submission to make things right with them. You can only be responsible for one person in the relationship. That's you. You can only be responsible for one person in the relationship, and that's you. Matthew 7:3, you've seen it 1,000 times, but let's throw it up on the screen. Jesus said, why point out the speck in another person's eye when you have a log jammed in your face? Right? Why have we spent so much time looking at the specks of sawdust in their brother's eye when we pay no attention to the log jam in our own face? It's like, it's saying, man, you need to be preoccupied with this thing that's like stuck in your head before we can even get to the point where we're trying to help our brother. And I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right. How can we expect God to begin the restorative work in our strained, broken relationships if we as individuals have not personally sought and hungered for God to begin the restorative work in our own lives? The beginning point of God mending and healing our broken relationships is when we prayerfully look at ourselves, humbly acknowledge our sinfulness, either to God or to other people, and then admit that in any way we have not been Jesus to another, we've contributed to the issue. I'm just telling you, the beginning point, that the best beginning point is ourselves. Let me say it again. The only beginning point is ourselves. And I've probably made more mistakes doing it the other way than doing it this way. I think that at this point I'm starting to get trained maybe by God in such a way where the beginning point for me, whenever, like, just here's an example, just the other day, I don't even know what was going on. I think it was miscommunication. Jenny and I had this kind of back and forth verbal thing going on, and then she left. And whenever she left, I thought, what did I just do? Not what did she do? I could be mad at her, I could be angry at her, but I thought, what in the world did I just do? Because I knew that I was the contributor to the issue, and I knew that the beginning point of that thing working itself out needed to begin with me. But think about this. This is a great beginning point for all of us. Can you imagine what it would look like if two people who took on this way actually did that? Like, can you think about the hurt in churches? Can you think about the divisiveness within churches? And the anger and the grudges and the sharp words that we shred each other with. Can you imagine if two people took on this way, what would happen? Man, what humble submission that would look like. What, you want to talk about something fractured that would come together quickly in unison, in unity for healing? That's what it would look like. Angie. To me, that sounds impossible, right? Right. It's right, but it's possible with God. It's completely impossible because I've seen the train wreck. I've seen it everywhere. I saw something the other day. Someone had posted something, and this Christian woman responded, and she said, so-and-so was talking about me and slandering my name, and I'm never talking to her again. And I was like, we're comfortable with that. We're comfortable with just saying, screw you. Get out of my life. I don't care if I ever see you again. No, I don't even care if I ever talk to you again. Because you're a jerk. You're an idiot. You're a fool.
And there are times when in our relationships, it's healthier just to walk away because the personalities clash and maybe there's so much bad history that each person needs
and that's why we're talking about it today. So you guys can grow, and I can grow, and we can grow together. Here we grow, right? Here we grow again.
We almost may have to start before we share our feelings.
I think so.
I think the share our feelings more open. And I think that, you know, when we'll show this is more Jesus. I don't recall Jesus saying, Peter, when you said that, you really made me...
Well, thanks for the prelude, because here we go. You ready for this? Chase, boom. Have you ever had anybody ignore you? Has it made you angry? Has it made you mad? So the way that I remember it, and we're going to go off on all the Jesus responses, all the Jesus ways that his life was demonstrated. If we can understand that Jesus was the perfect union, he was in perfect union with God because he was God in human form, then do you remember when the disciples wanted to call fire down from heaven to toast the people who were making fun of Jesus and yelling at him? Okay. They were ignoring Jesus, but he rebukes them and says, let's, you know, not crisp people like French fries. Let's go to the next one. Have you ever had anybody misunderstand you? I think the whole entire New Testament, every single one of the Gospels, is a demonstration in the disciples misunderstanding Jesus at every single moment, but yet him not giving up on them, him not telling them, I'm done with you guys because you're as thick as, you know, thick as mud, whatever you say. Let's look at the next one. Have you ever had anybody let you down? How about when Jesus was going to pray and he asked his disciples to stay awake and pray for him? What did they do? Fell asleep on him. We're getting progressively worse here. What about the next one? Imposing? Have you ever had anybody impose on you? How about when the mother of James and John asked Jesus if her sons could sit next to him in his coming kingdom? And Jesus is like, oh, do you just continue to have patience, continue to have grace. What about the next one? Have you ever had anybody betray you or deny you, betray your trust, hurt you in any way? Like, the thing that I find interesting about this is that, think about how mind-blowing this is. Jesus brings the disciples around the table. He gets out the wash basin with water and a towel on his side. He bends down to start washing the feet of his disciples. Do you know what else happens in that context? We know that there's a conversation between Jesus and Peter where he tells Peter, what? Very soon, you're going to deny me three times. You're going to turn your back on me. But what does Jesus do? Washes his feet. Is there anyone else sitting at the table? Judas? So you're telling me that Judas is sitting at the table. Jesus knows that there's someone that's going to betray him because he says it right there in that same passage. But yet as he works his way down the line, he washes the feet of Judas. If somebody was going to betray you and take your life, what would be your response? Get out of here. Get out of this room. You're not even welcome here. Or just walk up behind them and punch them in the head. Right? How would you respond to somebody who sold you out so that you would be put to death? Flip them the bird? I was just about ready to get way more. And that's completely inappropriate. Spit in their juice, in their wine, before you hand it to them. What kinds of things would you do? Burn with anger? Tell the other disciples to be against this one disciple? How about this one? Have you had anybody turn against you? Jesus riding the donkey into the town, about the people who were completely praising him, but who would very quickly turn their back on him, what was Jesus' response? Tears in his eyes. Hurting for the people. What's the next one, Chase? Have you ever had anybody that's hurt you or wounded you? How about hanging on a cross and asking God to forgive the people who are doing it? What if somebody's beating your brains out in the middle of it? Are you saying, God, forgive them? How about killing you? Well, none of you have been killed. But how about forgiving, being nailed to a cross and looking down and saying, God, forgive these people because they don't know what they're doing? I'm just telling you that the way of Jesus is impossible in your life unless the Spirit of God is working in your life, unless you found a union with God where God begins to reveal his ways to you. The greatest and fullest expression of love can only be experienced and demonstrated through the power of the Holy Spirit in our lives when we are joined perfectly with God. Our love moves from being very conditional to extraordinarily unconditional. Did you get that? Our love, our natural love that we all kind of have, is very conditional, but with the Spirit of God, it becomes very extraordinarily unconditional. Our love grows from a place of spiritual myopia, which we can only see very smallly, to a place of full seeing. The kind of love that Jesus expressed was a love that could see beyond just this moment. He could see people. He could see their heart. Our love matures beyond a law we must follow to a life that we become. We don't love people because we go to church and somebody says, well, Jesus told us to love, so we got to love. The love that we become, that we begin experiencing, is the kind of love that grows within us and manifests outward in our lives. It becomes naturally who we are rather than us just following the rules. Our love becomes wise, realizing that our battle is not against other people, not against flesh and bone. Our love weeps for the state of the world and the brokenness of humanity, and especially when we are victims of its pain, hurt, and oppression. The kind of love that we begin to express to other people is completely unconditional, even when it hurts us, even when it insults us, even when it pains us, and even when we're oppressed. This kind of love is not shaken when we are sinned against. This kind of love is not diminished when others talk behind our backs. This kind of love cannot be broken or by betrayal. This kind of love does not fade when people can't live up to the expectations that we have for them. Did you hear that? This kind of love does not fade when people don't live up to the expectations that you have for them. It's a consistent love that loves people regardless. This kind of love keeps serving, it keeps pursuing, it keeps extending grace, and it keeps forgiving even to the point of our death. And the question I ask you is, are you capable of this kind of love? We are not just followers of a law, but we have the opportunity of a lifetime to bring out the new treasures for the world to see. I'm going to read one final verse, and I want to read a story. Actually, I'm not there yet. Here's some thoughts that I had. We're not paralyzed by the thought of the impossible because we have a God that works through us to make all things possible. We're not simply lovers of God. We are those who have asked the Spirit of God to dwell in our hearts, minds, and souls so that we may be the embodiment of His unfailing love. Do you realize how ridiculous it would be for a group of people to say that they love God, but then not extend that love? You see how ridiculous and short-sighted that is? For there to be churches and churches of people that say, we love God, and we're going to sing His praises, and we're going to sing these songs together, but then walk out the door and belittle other people, throw sharp words at another person, love people conditionally based on their merit or what they look like or what they're wearing or how much money they make or what they've done or what sin group they're in. Do you realize how ridiculous that is for a group of people to stand in the presence of God on Sunday mornings and to say that they love God and they want His love lavished and poured on us, but to walk out the door and do anything less than love people? How in the world can we have strained and broken relationships on our end if we do this? Don't let it be because you've lacked love. Don't let it be because you've chosen anything else other than love. Paul would say it this way, and I've broken this up so we actually pay attention to it, because we've heard this ever since the day we were born. If I speak in the tongues of men or angels, but I do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all the mysteries and all the knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. Buddy, you could be the most religious, the most pious. You can speak in all the language of the religious. You can go to church every Sunday. You can say hallelujah and take your communion. You can wave your arms and flail back and forth and sing praises to God, but if you don't love, you are nothing. How do you like that? That's not me. That's Paul. I just got to say it. You are absolutely nothing if you don't love. What else? If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship, then I may boast, but I do not have love, I gain nothing. Be charitable. Help people all you want. Give your money. Give your time. Give all your resources. But do it in love. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered, and it keeps no record of wrongs. This is probably 3 months worth of teaching, right? These are words of your life. These are words to meditate on for your lifetime. If you don't walk out with anything else, then walk out with this. Write this down. Post it on your mirrors. Put it in your cars. Write it on your palm. I submit to you that healing, mending, forgiveness, and reconciliation begins when we've experienced the immense and profound love of God, and it changes us. It begins with us. God did not manipulate, strong arm, or coerce any of us for our hearts to change. Did God? Did God coerce you? Did God manipulate you? Did God strong arm you for your heart to change? Nope. He extended his unconditional love, his unconditional grace, his unconditional forgiveness, and humble submission. That is how hearts and minds change, and that is the example and pattern we follow. You will never strong arm, come over top of anybody for their heart to change. You might change their behavior, but you won't change their heart. They might do it because you said so, because you're coming over the top of them, but they'll be angry about it. They'll hold animosity. But if you have the kind of love that comes underneath of people that is humble and submissive, that's the beginning place where hearts are changed. That's where shalom begins. That's where the healing, complete healing of relationships begin. Is it begins with us, and it begins with us following that humble, submissive pathway of showing people unconditional love. I don't think that there's any way for true healing to happen unless it's that way, because it's God's way, and it's God's way working out through us. In any way that we haven't been Jesus to another person, we've contributed to the problem. Story. Thanks to Shelley for this. It'd be easy, expected even, for Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel to be enemies. After all, he killed Johnson's only son in 1993. He went to prison for that, and toward the end of his sentence, he and Johnson made peace. As a teenager in Minneapolis, Israel was involved with gangs and drugs. One night at a party, he got in a fight with her son, 20 years old, and shot and killed him. O'Shea is now 34. He finished serving his prison sentence for murder about a year and a half ago. Israel recently visited StoryCorps with Johnson to discuss their relationship and the forgiveness it is built upon. As Johnson recalls, their first face-to-face conversation took place while he was still in prison, and when Israel agreed to her repeated request to see him. Did you get that? She was the one pursuing the killer. I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remembered from court, where I wanted to go over and hurt you, Johnson tells Israel, but you were not that 16-year-old. You were a grown man. I shared with you about my son, and he became human to me, Israel says. At the end of their meeting at the prison, Johnson was overcome by emotion. The initial thing to do was just try and hold you up as best as I can, Israel says. Just hug you like I would my own mother. Johnson says, after you left the room, I began to say, I just hugged the man that murdered my son. And I instantly knew that all that anger and animosity, all the stuff that I had in my heart for 12 years for you, I knew it was over, and I had totally forgiven you. Going to a separate article about the same woman. Sunday afternoon at the St. Jean House, the Visitation Sisters Lay Retreat Center and House of Hospitality located just blocks from their monastery held such images of forgiveness when a welcome home party was thrown for a young man named O'Shea Israel. This was not a party for a returning college student, nor a young man coming back from military service, a backpacker making his way home after a European adventure, nor a returning Peace Corps volunteer. This was a welcoming home of extreme, prodigal son proportions. When the youthful O'Shea returned to his community after serving a 17-year jail sentence for killing another man, the thrower of this party was none other than the mother of the murdered son. Mary Johnson received O'Shea Israel with open arms at St. Jean House. As an outsider to the Sunday's experience, I stood in awe. I know Mary's story of forgiving O'Shea firsthand, having heard her share this tale on two separate privileged occasions. It never ceases to amaze me or boggle my mind with questions. What does it mean to forgive your only son's murderer? Who does such a thing? Who is Mary Johnson? What exists in her heart? What does she know? What kind of faith does she possess? What has shaped her life and her heart and her mind? How does O'Shea respond and relate to this kind of love? Man, I'm telling you, the ripple effect of that kind of love is profound. Because you know what? Within that one woman of extending love, grace, and forgiveness to a murderer of her own son, where there's healing between them, because she's experienced the powerful love of God enough to have it in her heart and express it to somebody else who doesn't deserve it. But now guess what? Their relationship is like a mother and a son. And because of that, look who's talking about it. Shelley posted on Facebook it for everybody to read. We're talking about it here. I'm talking about it in here. I'm just telling you, the kind of ripple effect of this kind of love is so profound. And it's the kind of love that we're called to as Christians. It's not something that we easily dismiss. It's not something that we say, yeah, but that's Jesus and we're not Jesus. It's not, well, that's Mary Johnson and she's just a better Christian than I am. I'm just telling you that the simple, easy answer is open your heart up to the love of God yourself and accept His healing in your life so that we too may begin to experience that kind of extension of His love to other people. Let's pray. God, we know that we've been given an awesome responsibility, not out of compulsion, not out of strong-arming or arm-twisting, but we've been given the awesome experience of just being able to share in your unconditional love that's been lavished on each one of us to such a degree, God, that it actually begins changing our hearts and our minds that we do the absolute impossible because it's not us doing it, it's you. And we know that the kind of healing that has to take place within our families, within our churches, within our communities, begins with each one of us opening our hearts to you working in our lives. God, we are incapable of doing such ridiculous, miraculous things. I don't have it in my heart and in my very nature to extend that kind of love to people. It's only through you revealing yourself and working in me and changing my heart and the way that I see people to even begin to take steps of doing something like that. God, I pray for our church here right now. I pray for each person here who's been holding on to something that they need to let go of. God, that your love would be made manifest in their own lives. God, that they may see it more clearly and experience it. God, that they would take the ridiculous and impossible steps of extending forgiveness and love to people that they've had strained and broken relationships with. God, that it would be one of humble submission. God, that it wouldn't be strong-arming or taking people from the top. God, I pray that we can be the greatest demonstration of your love here at this church that this community has ever seen. God, we pray for your heart and your soul and your wisdom in our